Welcome to the Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. Now, if you were listening to the last episode of the podcast, you'll have heard me and Michael Hutchinson getting all nostalgic about the time when Britain was a nation of cyclists. The fact that such a time was many years before either of us was even born only gives the nostalgia the sharper, somewhat more tragic edge. My guest on the podcast today is a man who's written a book about how countries like Britain, America, Australia can once again become bike nations and why that would be a very good thing. Peter Walker is a journalist at The Guardian newspaper. In 2009, he set up The Guardian's bike blog, which has gone on to become one of the go-to places for reading, writing and debate on cycling, and not just covering stories in the UK, but all around the world. Welcome to The Bike Show, Peter.
Thank you very much. Hello.
So you write on the bike blog. You've written this book, Bike Nation, that we're going to be talking about. And a few years ago, you were ranked as in the top 50 most influential people in British cycling. But your day job isn't cycling at all, is it?
No, I've been a news journalist for most of my working life, and I'm now a politics journalist. So I'm based in Westminster, and everything I've done on the bike blog has been basically in any spare time that I've got, which is sometimes a bit, but often it's not very much, which, you know, if you do read the bike blog, that's sometimes why there's a big gap between posts.
We've all got our own kind of evolutionary paths as people who ride bikes, how we got from, you know, when we were born to where we are now. Maybe do you want to tell me about yours and how you became someone who rides a bike and now someone who's written a book about people who ride bikes?
Well, of course. I mean, I did the kind of usual thing that, you know, most kids do. I kind of rode bikes around and stuff like that. But then I went through a period from about, I don't know, 14 or 15, as I kind of discovered, you know, girls and pubs and things like that, where I just didn't really. And I had asthma as a child, which was actually quite bad, which kind of affected a certain number of things that I did. But it meant I wasn't particularly good at sports. And certainly kind of into my teens, I didn't do a lot of physical activity at all. But then I left university and got a very secure but very dull graduate job. And kind of on a whim, I decided to give it up to become a cycle courier, which in London at the time was, you know, quite a kind of fringe thing to do. But this was kind of when email was only just starting to come in. So in that era, you could actually earn quite a lot of cash. And so I spent a couple of years in London doing that. And then I moved to Australia for a couple of years, and I was doing that for some of the time there too. And basically, you know, once you've cycled for 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, then cycling becomes a really, really big part of your life. And ever since then, I've just ridden bikes loads. I was into kind of adventure and sports riding. I did kind of, you know, long tours, and I did bits of mountain biking, road biking. You know, I never particularly raced all that much, but it was probably as much as anything starting to write the bike blog, because I helped to set that up because The Guardian didn't really have any coverage of cycling that wasn't just sports writing. And I thought it'd be an interesting thing to talk about. And my initial thoughts for it was just, you know, let's write about biking as fun. Let's try out new bikes. Let's do this, you know, very much for the kind of hobbyist thing. But the more I wrote about it, and thus the more I thought about cycling as a kind of entity, I did realise that in one sense, people like me who have, you know, opinions on their gear ratios and get kind of bike-themed Christmas presents and see cycling as a kind of reasonably big part of their life are just only ever going to be a tiny percentage of the potential people who could ride bikes. And if at all possible, it'd be great if you could just get everybody riding a bike, not because, you know, it's a hobby, but just because it's a good thing to do.
Can you summarise where the world is in terms of cycling? And I guess the cycling that we're going to be talking about at the minute, maybe it does help to narrow it down a bit, is cycling to get around, cycling as transport, not the kind of cycling that I was talking about much more with Michael Hutchinson last time, which was cycling as a pastime, cycling as sport. So this is cycling to get around. Where is the world in cycling terms?
It's at this kind of strange, almost pivotal moment, if you want to see it in that way. Obviously, you've got the nations like the Dutch and the Danes and to a lesser extent the Germans and some other European countries and, you know, various other nations where everyday cycling is just part of the way people live. But then you've got other places, not necessarily entire countries, but certainly cities like certainly London, some other places in the UK, New York City, various places in Australia, where there is this very, very big push. And you're starting to see this move beyond just people who ride to work as being the kind of, you know, the freaks, you know, as in, I mean that in a kind of, you know, positive sense, the ones with the kind of outliers who really like it. And you're starting to see more and more and more everyday people doing it. And that is as much led by anything else as wherever there are the proper separated bike lanes and the other infrastructure people need. And it's a really interesting thing for me because, you know, I do kind of wonder where things are going. But the signs are that if you were a policymaker, then cycling just makes more sense than everything else. You know, if you just take Britain, more or less any politician you'll speak to will say that if we don't do something very, very quickly, the NHS will be bankrupt, social care will run out of money, you know, pollution in London alone is killing, you know, who, depending who you talk to, 10 or 20,000 people a year. The city is completely seizing up because it's completely gridlocked. Global warming is a massive problem. And yet, if you suddenly get kind of Dutch or Danish levels of people riding bikes, 25-30%, then all of those things suddenly become much, much better. So, you know, maybe I've got so much invested in it that I would think this, but I think that a lot of policymakers are gradually starting to realise that something does need to be done.
That's a very positive spin on things, I have to say.
Maybe over positive.
I mean, because I was reading a book, I can't remember the name of it, a few months ago, a kind of global history of cycling, I think it what it was. And it basically pointed out the fact that cycling is in decline in global terms, simply because China has kind of given up. And so if you were to look at all the cycling in the world, we are on the downward path at the minute because of China. But that, and obviously a lot of these global statistics are heavily skewed by what China is doing, because China is whatever, a quarter of the world's population. Yet it is somehow symbolic of the process of urbanization and the car culture that has been the feature of the 20th century. And it does feel like that, though there are pockets of optimism, and there's certainly, when you, and you go to the Netherlands and there's loads of cycling, you go to Denmark, there's loads of cycling, it still feels very, very marginal in global terms. And also even in places like London, it does feel kind of scary. And the way that cycling is covered in the media is still as a bit of a cranky kind of strange thing. There's an awful lot of hostility out there. Can we just try and unpick some of this about how we got to this point, from a point where the bicycle was a pretty uncontroversial means of transport, lots of people did it, to a point where we've got this kind of war on the roads, it feels like, a lot of the time?
I mean, it's a strange one. China is a very interesting one, because they're almost seeing what you could argue in one way is a kind of accelerated kind of curve of what the more developed nations in the West did. And yes, I mean, you know, the number of cars and car use in China has increased massively. I mean, I lived in China for a couple of years in kind of 2001, 2002. And Beijing then had a lot of cars, but there were still quite big bike lanes and you'd see quite a few people on bikes. And since then, the number of cyclists has declined massively. And yet, even in China, you can argue that you can almost say we're at the kind of trough and things are starting to pick up. For example, public bike share systems like the London Boris bikes in China, they're really, really taking off. Hangzhou, which is in, from memory, southern China, has got the world's biggest bike share system. It's got something like 60,000 bikes. And all these Chinese places which are suddenly kind of completely choked with cars are thinking we need to do something quickly. And one of the oddities is that because they're so undemocratic and centralized and planned, that cities can do things like that. So they can suddenly build a metro system and then make sure that there's a high bike system, you know, outside. So they've got bikes outside every single train station. And there are some people who are saying that that's starting to happen. I mean, you know, obviously China is just one example. India is kind of motorizing very, very quickly, and that any change there will, you know, take a bit more time. But in terms of this kind of general idea of cyclists being seen as an oddity, it's one which is very, very prevalent, as I'm sure you know very well, in the media, particularly in places like Britain, Australia, America, and so on. But my argument is it's probably as much a factor of the fact that not many people do ride bikes. As you point out, for all the fuss about increased, you know, cycling numbers in a few places, the overall levels for cycling in Britain aren't really going up. They're still at kind of 1-2% of all trips. But, you know, transport can suddenly change really, really quickly. You do get these kind of moments when people realize that the status quo is just not really working and it can change fast. And obviously, I'm guessing, I don't know if it will be the case, but if there is ever going to be a pivotal moment for cycling coming back, then this is it.
Yeah, I mean, people kind of have been saying that
for a while, haven't they? There's that, I think Joe Dunkley, who writes for the War on the Motorist blog, which is well worth reading, trawled Hansard, which is I guess you're familiar with Hansard in your new job as a political reporter, to pull out all the quotes by British ministers of transport saying we are on the verge of a bicycle revolution, and going back to the early 1970s, and it's always sort of, it's just about to happen. Do you think this time is different, and can you diagnose why those prophecies of the past fail to come true?
Well, the reason they didn't come true is I think that pretty much 99 times out of 100, when a transport minister says that, they're just saying the words, they don't actually mean it. I mean, in the past, it has never really been backed up with considerable amounts of money to, for example, build a coherent network of bike lanes, or to kind of disincentivize car use for smaller journeys, you know, which are things which you do need. And it's kind of the job of whoever gets the kind of handed the task, whichever junior transport minister gets a cycling brief. They, you know, almost under law, I have to say, every few years, this is it. Cycling is going to be brilliant. You know, we're going to invest an extra £50 million. It's going to change the world, which is not going to. And what I think could potentially change it, and I stress could, isn't suddenly you have, you know, politicians in power who think this is amazing, this is a positive choice. I almost think it's going to be the negative externalities of driving which push them into doing it. And I really think that health is going to be, you know, one of the big things, because if you talk to MPs, they all know that there is a massive, massive, massive funding crisis, both in central and local government, for the fact that people live essentially inactive lives. You know, it's connected to lots of other things. They live longer, and, you know, there's all stuff connected to pensions. But the fact that people, you know, vast numbers of people in Britain are doing very, very little exercise means that they need to have long-term treatment for conditions like diabetes type 2 and vascular illnesses and stuff like that. And there is really no other way of doing it other than getting people living a healthier life. And, you know, if you talk to any public health expert, they will say, you can encourage people all you want to go to the gym. You can say, go for a walk every day, and that might last for a few weeks and people stop. But if you integrate it into their everyday lives, then that's what makes a change. And it's things like public health, pollution, global warming, those kind of negative effects of not doing something, you know, could potentially push ministers into actually finally trying to make the change.
What do you think is the timescale for those kinds of payoffs in public health? Because politicians are notoriously short-termist. They're thinking about the next election, if they're thinking about anything in the future, and they're not thinking about a lifespan. And if you get a child cycling to school now, then they'll ride a bike, and as they grow older, they won't become obese, so they won't get type 2 diabetes when they're 50, by which time the politician will be, you know, retired and probably long since 6 feet under. Do politicians think long-term like that?
The problem is that when they do think long-term, they tend to think in terms of kind of grand projects. So, for example, you have politicians who 20 years ago were starting to plan Crossrail, or similar amount of time ago were starting to think about, is Heathrow going to get another runway? And these are things which will probably, you know, open beyond their term in office. But, you know, there is this thing that one former transport minister described as grand project itis, that kind of stuff is kind of fun. It's fun to commission, you know, a £2 billion project. Whereas the problem with bike lanes is a lot of it is quite mundane stuff. It's, you know, very basic of building curbs, calming traffic, you know, doing stuff which is in engineering terms very low tech. And if there is an argument why, you know, this big step change in cycling won't take place, it is because, as you say, it's long term and also kind of quite unglamorous stuff. So you kind of almost need a few politicians to show how it's done. And in London, Boris Johnson, you know, whatever his many flaws, did actually do that. So it's kind of a combination of these external factors with also a bit of luck too.
I mean, one of the things that gets me as a cyclist who thinks about cycling and transport from the point of view of riding a bike is the sheer amount of violence and death that there is on the roads. And there's a tremendous chapter of your book that covers this really well. And I think the statistics from the World Health Organization is 1.3 million violent deaths on the roads a year globally, which is far more than gun crime or knife crime or terrorism or all the kinds of violent deaths that shoot to the top of the political agenda every now and then in response to another outrage. I just don't understand how come we've become so inured as a society. I mean, I'm certainly not inured as a person, as an individual. And in a sense, I think most other people are. If they have a family member who's killed on the roads, you know, that's a profoundly life-changing event for them and may well change their perspective. But as a society, we've got this amazing blind spot. The older I get, the more baffled I am by it.
I'm kind of the same, and I think it's as with any subject like this, the more you look into it, the more you realise this is just completely crazy. You know, and I'm not, obviously, particularly given recent events, I don't mean to downplay the terrorism threat, but one of the calculations that I did in the book is, I can't remember the precise dates, but over something like 8 or 9 years, the number of people killed by terrorism in Britain was roughly the number who killed on the roads every day and a half. And it's pretty much, you know, in a kind of industrialized, reasonably safe society like Britain, it's pretty much the only area of life where a kind of sudden and violent death through the negligence or inattention of someone else is seen as a kind of accident, as the word goes, is seen as kind of normal. And possibly that chapter was the one that, you know, emotionally affected me the most, because the more you think about it in that kind of dispassionate way, the more crazy it is. And, you know, you have got some things changing. You've got the Vision Zero movement. You've got Ropeace in Britain, who do a lot of fantastic work. But this weirdly is almost even more than riding a bike. It's a slightly fringe thing. When you go on about road deaths, people look at you as if you're a bit of a crank. And I don't generally know what the answer is. I mean, you know, perhaps it'll just be something that will change if and when transport systems change. So if you do have a city where transport is much lower speed and based much more about foot and bikes, then inevitably fewer people will, you know, be maimed or killed. So it might even need to, you know, wait for something like that. But all the while that's going on, you know, particularly in poorer countries, you get the great majority of poorer people in those countries who don't own cars, who are riding bikes and walking along the side of roads or trying to cross roads, and are being killed by people in cars at a massive rate. And it's completely astonishing.
And it seems as though people have been willing to make a trade-off collectively between a kind of hyper-individualized mobility that the car offers and its enormous death toll. And they say, well, it's, you know, overall, it's worth it. Say if they introduced a new kind of technology dreamt up by the boffin somewhere, where you could teleport yourself around the world, like Star Trek, you know, so you could instantaneously transport yourself to places, and it would be fine, it would work, you know, you'd pay some money for it, but there would probably be about 1 million people who would vaporize and wouldn't appear at the other end of their journey. And I wonder whether we would, as a society, declare that that technology is a bit too risky, a bit too dangerous for us. But we've sort of become used to cars because they've been around since all of us on the planet were born, and they're sort of a fact of life. But we don't seem to be able to look at them with an objective eye. I mean, apart from, you know, for those of us, and I do get the crank thing totally. That I feel like I'm some kind of sort of evangelical person who's had the scales lifted from my eyes, and I'm sort of shaking people. And why can't you see it the way I see it? My God, you're crazy! And then I realize that I've come across as a crazy person. But I feel like I can't quite let it go.
I think the kind of big thing which kind of makes people almost without realizing it accept the death toll is this illusion that you've got control of whether or not it happens to you, because, you know, people think, well, I'm driving a car, I can drive incredibly slowly, I can, you know, drive carefully, or lots of people think that they're good drivers, and they maybe don't think about the fact that, you know, that someone can just cross over a lane and bash into you, and that's it, and it's out of your control. But the other thing is too that this illusion of control is kind of passed on to the more vulnerable road users too. So hence the fact the safety debate for people on bikes is based largely around, you know, helmets or high-vis jackets or stuff like that. And it's pretty much the only area of transport where the responsibility is placed on the most vulnerable people. You know, you don't go to an airport and they say, well, your flight's, you know, over there somewhere, here's a kind of, you know, yellow jacket, put it on, mind out for the taxiing planes. Just people wouldn't accept that. And there is an argument, you know, which I go into a little bit in that chapter in the book. It's part of almost not quite a concerted campaign, but certainly a kind of implicit campaign by the kind of car industry, you know, from the kind of very start of cars, was that it was, you know, they were in charge of the roads and it was up to everyone else to kind of be careful for them. And if they got squashed, that was fundamentally their own fault.
Well, let's talk about advocacy and campaigning, because I think we've got ourselves into a pretty depressing spot here in terms of our conversation. So let's try and kind of get ourselves out of it. And you've talked to a lot of bicycle advocates and bicycle campaigners in the book, and there's some really interesting insights there for all of us who may be involved in our own small way in our local dealings with the local authority, or working with our own cycle groups, or writing to our MPs, or just even talking to friends, because it's quite difficult as someone who rides a bike not to get drawn into these conversations sometimes. What are some of the best and the most effective, powerful bits of bike advocacy? And then we're going to come to some of the own goals in a minute, just to keep a little bit of the gloom into the conversation. But some of the best things that you've seen people do.
Well, you know, one of the most inspiring stories that I heard is the Montreal one. So, I mean, for those who've not been there, it's you know, by kind of Dutch or Danish levels, they haven't got enormous numbers of people who ride bikes. It's something like 8 or 9 or 10% of trips are made by bike, but in a reasonably hilly place, which has, you know, winters which are very fierce, that's actually pretty good. And a lot of that is down to these slightly eccentric campaigning groups which sprung up in the kind of late 70s. And they did a lot of the kind of tactics that, you know, that the Dutch protesters also did. They did die-ins. There was this famous campaign who took this very kind of theatrical approach to it. It was Bob Silverman, known as Bicycle Bob. There was this big campaign that to cross the St. Lawrence River, it wasn't actually possible on a bike because all the bridges were for cars only. And there's none we could get across on a bike. So they tried to hire a canoe to carry bikes across. They invited a lot of press photographers, and he stood by the river dressed in a Moses costume that they rented from a store, and kind of, you know, held his big wooden staff in the air and tried to part the waters. And stuff like that, you know, it kind of depends on the historical context. So there's also another kind of less theatrical group working in the background who's lobbying, you know, the local members of parliament, you know, to provide the funding for the bridge. But it took them quite a long time. But in the end now, they've got a reasonably coherent network of proper bike lanes. So that was a really, really interesting one. I mean, one of the things I also found, which is, again, a slightly more kind of gloomy thing, is a certain amount of it just depends on luck. So, for example, you know, the New York city change is almost always just because they had a mayor, Mike Bloomberg, who, you know, whilst he's obviously not a kind of passionate bike rider, when he first got into office, he commissioned this big report into how, you know, New York could cope with the fact that they were estimating in the next 10 or so years there's going to be an extra million or so people who wanted to live there. And, you know, he's someone who's a kind of very rational level headed person. You know, he set up his own business, is a billionaire. And the conclusion that they reach is you have to have a lot more people riding bikes. So he set up and helped to build a vast number of bike lanes. And that is almost kind of pure chance. And, you know, London's bike lanes are quite similar too. You had Boris Johnson, who was someone who rode a bike and got a second term as mayor, knew he was not going to stand for a third term, and just, you know, thought he had nothing to lose. So he just built lots and lots of bike lanes. It's a kind of real mixture, really.
It does seem that it often does rely upon some charismatic individuals, whether they are advocates or especially, I think, people in positions of power. And that, to me, is worrying because, as you mentioned, it's chance. It doesn't seem as if it's a kind of done deal in terms of policymaking, that it depends upon someone at the top who's, you know, to use the phrase, got it.
I guess so. I mean, you know, there's also the kind of low-level stuff. So, for example, when Mike Bloomberg announced he was going to build all the bike lanes, there was obviously a big public backlash against it, but there were these cycling advocacy groups who've been working in the city for 20 years, and they kind of laid the groundwork, so they were able to help the New York Transportation Department kind of go from business to business and kind of tell them, look, a bike lane isn't going to kill your trade, it's going to be good for you, and they kind of really helped to introduce that kind of stuff. And it's the same true, I mean, with the London bike lanes. Whenever there's been a consultation on them, you have people like the London Cycling Campaign and, you know, CTC and various other people like that who will say to their members, look, if you want this bike lane to be built, then take part and show that there are lots of people out there who do want to ride bikes. And one of the things that I found talking to campaigners and talking to politicians and talking to people involved in this kind of thing, they're saying it's quite easy to kind of pontificate on Facebook or Twitter, but that doesn't actually change that much. You tend to just be talking to people who, you know, think the same way. And what you really need to do is to lobby your local councillor, lobby your MP, lobby anyone to show that the kind of NIMBYs who are against bike lanes aren't the only people. Because often cycling advocates are quite kind of, you know, slow at doing that kind of thing. And it's, you know, really, really boring kind of advocacy trench work. But without that, then, you know, very little is going to get done.
And can you think of any examples of cycle advocacy that's been pretty much counterproductive? I mean, what's comes to my mind are on a macro scale in the 1990s when the Labour government came to power with Tony Blair in 1997, there was quite a strong possibility of a different kind of transport policy with John Prescott, and there was a window of opportunity. I think the political scientists describe it, but the various bicycle alliance groups in the UK fell out with each other over what they should be asking for, with in the classic debate over segregated provision and kind of rights to ride in the road and not be run over. The sort of the two wings of the bike advocacy constituency. And government just turned around and said, well, look, if you can't agree on what you want, then we're just going to take a break and get on with what we're going to do. And, you know, maybe once you've made up your mind, come back to us. And obviously the window of opportunity slammed shut and that was it.
To an extent, a certain amount of that is now in the past, because certainly in Britain, pretty much any bike advocacy group, barring, you know, a few individuals, believe that the kind of more Dutch-Danish style system is the way to do it. It was held back, I think, in, you know, more than a few places by this fact that the advocacy groups tended to be dominated by the kind of keen riders who thought that everyone should be able to kind of take a lane and kind of keep their cadence up and, you know, ride with traffic. You know, particularly in the US, you had, you know, what is now the League of American Bicyclists was set up as League of American Wheelmen, which was dominated by that creed for many, many years. And I was in touch with them to write the book, and they told me they only changed over from that kind of vehicular cycling approach about 6 or 7 years ago. So that really kind of slowed things down. Now, I tend to think that if there is a problem with advocacy, well, I guess there's two things. There's the thing I mentioned before. It's the people who would much, much, much rather kind of pontificate on Twitter rather than actually do anything. And, you know, those tend to be the people who are keen to argue over a really, really tiny point. I've got a few people on Twitter who kind of believe I'm part of a motor industry confidence trick because I write for The Guardian. I can't possibly be, you know, serious about getting more people riding bikes. But then at the other level, I think you get the people who are very, very keen, but get bogged down in minor details. So, for example, this might, you know, hopefully not too many, but upset a few people listening. This whole debate about whether you call people riding bikes cyclists, you know, there's this big thing about don't call, you know, don't use that word. They're just someone riding a bike. And I do, you know, get reasonably regular emails and kind of tweets saying, why do you use that word? Why don't you just say people riding bikes? And I understand the basic point. I understand that you don't want to make a cyclist seem like a separate breed. And it does, to an extent, play into this kind of narrative of cyclists being a kind of outgroup and being different. But by the same token, I think in the grand scheme of things, that's a fairly small thing. I think the language will have less meaning when you get more people riding bikes, you know, rather than the other way around.
And do you think that investment in elite level Olympic cycling has a kind of trickle-down effect in terms of everyday cycling? And it's quite a topical issue right now because British cycling is going through all kinds of crises about other stuff than this. But the basic idea is that UK Sport set up a new policy when they had an infusion of money from the National Lottery, which basically said the most important thing for us is Olympic medals and gold medals especially, and we'll allocate the money according to which sports can get us the most gold medals. And cycling, you know, being a sort of fairly niche marginal sport in terms of global participation, but having quite a large number of medals at the Olympics, They thought, well, that's a good place to get a good return on our money in terms of medals. And, you know, there'll be a trickle-down effect, which we'll talk about as well, that get more people riding, healthy nation, all the other kind of things you've been talking about the good things about cycling. And I suppose the same arguments have been made by Team Sky as well, which is also experiencing its own not unrelated issues in relation to the way it runs itself, that it's talked a lot about having success at elite level being a spark for a sort of bicycling revolution in everyday life. Clearly, we do have the mammal, the middle-aged man in Lycra. It's a feature of society that there wasn't 15 years ago. But do you get the sense that there is a connection and that it is worth spending all this money on elite-level cycling to get a kind of payoff in terms of everyday cycling? Does that causation hold true to you?
Not particularly. I think if the government decides it wants to spend a lot of national lottery money on cycling so we get a lot of gold medals and, you know, Britain gets to feel really good about itself once every 4 years, I think that's fine. And I think certainly Olympic success has played a small role in the past. So, for example, after the 2008 Olympics, you suddenly got an upsurge of people who were very, very interested in cycling for sport, and velodromes were all booked out and things like that. You know, you have the other thing, you have the advocacy thing. So British Cycling as an organisation are probably, I would say, the most effective advocates for everyday cycling in Britain at the moment. And Chris Boardman, who's their kind of policy chief, is the most successful, you know, the most kind of eloquent individual advocate that there is. But the kind of big caveat is that there has to be, if you ever want to get more than, you know, 3 or 4% of people riding bikes, there has to be this shift away from this idea of cycling being a kind of a pursuit, a hobby, where you need specialist equipment, you know, and there has to be this shift over to it being nothing more than kind of walking, but you get to go there, you know, that much more kind of quickly, much more, again, to the kind of Dutch or Danish way. And for that, I think, you know, the sports success can maybe help push you from 2% of people, you know, using bikes for their trips to maybe 3 or 4%. But beyond that, it has to be the much, much bigger stuff, like central government building infrastructure, central government taking measures to make driving less easy. You know, I don't think it's a bad thing. And I think the British Cycling has done, you know, really, really, really good things. But there's kind of a limit to how far they can push it.
And what do you think the role of children is in cycle advocacy? We're both dads, and I certainly feel that riding with my children, who are 3 and 1.5 on the bike, and riding with them and thinking about their lives growing up and what it's going to be like, that has sort of changed my views a little bit, or maybe just sort of sharpened some of the edges, I suppose, because I'm worried about them ultimately, and I want them to kind of have some of the freedoms that I had when I was young. I've also kind of become aware through my work with the Abergavenny Cycle Group, which is our local cycling campaign here in the town where I live in Southeast Wales, that kids are brilliant ambassadors in a cycle campaign. That, you know, when you get the kids up on the, you know, in the front of the photo shoot, and you make the arguments in terms of keeping the children safe, childhood freedom, which is something that David Hembro, who's a kind of Brit based over in Holland, talks a lot about the lost freedom of childhood.
I think it's a really, really good point, because, you know, certainly for me, my son is now 6, you know, so I don't carry him around now on the back of a bike. It's a bit too big. But certainly when I first started to carry him around on a bike, you know, he was on one of those kind of, he would have been like about a year old. He's one of those seats which goes on a crossbar, you know, so you kind of got your arms around them. And riding a bike like that, you're immediately aware of the kind of vulnerable position that you're in, and incredibly, incredibly aware of the traffic all around you. And certainly for me, it kind of pushed me along on my journey away from being this kind of gung-ho cyclist who'd been a courier and, you know, could cope with any kind of traffic, into thinking, you know, this isn't right. There really, really has to be a kind of better way than this. And I think there's two things. So, you know, now he's 6, he, you know, rides his own bike. He's recently got his first bike with gears, which is slightly terrifying, because he can now go really, really quick. And there is this thing that it kind of pushes me to campaign all the more, because it makes me think, well, I'd love him to be able to cycle safely on the roads. You know, in certain Danish towns, they have a policy that kids should be able to cycle to school on their own from the age of 6. But obviously, you know, in Britain, you would never, ever, ever do that. And I think the other really, really brilliant thing about seeing kids on bikes is that, you know, bikes humanize a kind of traffic environment. And the less they look like a kind of traditional, like, sport rider, then the more kind of humanizing that does. And that's why I think bicycle share systems are so good. So when the London bike share system came into force in about whenever it was 2012, you suddenly had this big contingent of people who were cycling around who weren't wearing lycra, weren't wearing helmets, and they were often like families of tourists, and they weren't kind of, you know, getting their head down cycling to a destination as quickly as they were just kind of going from place to place, but doing it in a kind of very relaxed way. And I think that kind of human element is the kind of key for making people realize, you know, what more cycling can do for a place. And I think kids are the best exemplar of that, because there's no, you know, there's few more joyful sights in the world of seeing a kid on a bike.
It does make the case that cycling is fun, and cycling is kind of unusual as a sort of mode of transport, which, you know, think, oh, riding on the bus is fun, or taking the tube is fun. So some people think driving a car is fun, and I suppose if you're on some mountain road in the Rocky Mountains, maybe it is fun, but generally it's pretty miserable in a car. But cycling is something that is fun, and I think most people, even though we have had this sort of great extinction of cycling, can still remember that fun of being a child on a bike. And when they see a child on a bike, that kind of wakes that up in them. It reminds them of that. And then I think maybe it's a bit of a less of a step to think, well, you know what, maybe that, you know, cycling would be fun now for me as a 20, 30, 50-year-old, 60-year-old person.
I think that's a really interesting point, and it's something that, you know, can't be emphasized enough, because sometimes the debate about bikes can get down to this slightly kind of arcane and technical and dull debate about kind of curb heights and traffic lights and, you know, helmets and things like that. And, you know, I ride a bike partly because it's good for me. I ride a bike because I don't like to kind of pollute where I live, but I mainly do it because it's a very easy way to get around. It's also fun. If I get the train into work, which I occasionally need to do, then I don't feel awake when I get in. But if I ride my bike, you know, it's not a particularly long journey, it's about 3 or 4 miles, I get in, I feel energized, and, you know, I enjoy my commute into work, which most people don't really get to do. And I think that's an incredibly important thing. One of the things I really enjoyed finding out about during the research for this book is that there is a Danish charity, have you heard of them? This one called Cycling Without Age.
No, I haven't.
They have this thing that they arrange volunteers to ride these kind of big rickshaw-like cargo bikes. So people who are too old or too ill to be able to ride a bike themselves can basically be put in the front of this rickshaw thing and pedaled round. So they get the feeling of being on the bike again. And it's proved incredibly popular. It was only set up about 4 or 5 years ago, but they've got branches in about a dozen countries or stuff like that. And their kind of motto, translated from the Danish, is the right to feel the wind in your hair, which is really kind of summing up what the kind of, you know, joy of riding a bike is.
Yeah, that's quite right. Yeah, I mean, I saw a tweet a few months ago by Sir Nicholas Soames, who is a member of Parliament. Is he a sir? I think he's a sir, isn't he? He's a very portly kind of traditional Tory MP. I think is he the grandson of Winston Churchill? Yeah. So he's, you can imagine him having great big lunches in some gentleman's club, and he always looks very well turned out, and he's got this plummy kind of voice. And he tweeted about how he just got his new bicycle and how it was great fun tearing around Westminster. And I think he had an e-bike, pretty sure, because I think he put a picture of it on, and it was an e-bike. I am a massive booster for e-bikes. I think that they are going to change the game for a lot of people. People like Nicholas Soames, who might have had an enormous lunch at the Carlton Club. Or if you live around here in South Wales, where it's hilly and not everyone wants to break a sweat when they have to go somewhere. Do you look into e-bikes and new technologies?
Well, I kind of did, you know, because one of the, you know, obviously one of the biggest paradoxes really of the story of kind of increasing urbanization and what role bikes can play is that most bikes, the design hasn't really fundamentally changed for about 120 or so years. But at the same time, I think in Britain we're quite insulated from the e-bike world, but certainly on continental Europe they're massive. The sales figures are, from memory, that in the Netherlands certainly something like getting close to 50% of all new bikes bought there are e-bikes. And in Germany, it's a very, very similar thing. And, you know, they've got very obvious things, for example, if you live in a hilly area. But the other thing as well is that they're helping people commute quite a lot longer. So when I was talking to the Copenhagen infrastructure mayor, because they kind of divide the mayoralty in about six or seven different roles, and he's saying that with the advent of e-bikes, they're able to now build these really, really long straight bike lanes, which means people can commute into the centre of town from about maybe 6 or 7 miles or even, you know, further than that, which in the past they wouldn't necessarily wanted to do. But the other thing too is that certainly for the Dutch, e-bikes have really, really helped older people being able to stay riding a bike for longer. And the cycle campaigners there I was talking to were saying there's increasing numbers of Dutch people who get, for example, into their late 70s and feel they're no longer, you know, willing to drive a car, but will quite happily use an e-bike to kind of get around and visit family and friends and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it has this real potential to make cycling this kind of incredibly inclusive thing, which more or less any person in more or less any area can do. I mean, there's the other thing too, that I was speaking to a disability mobility campaigner, and she uses a hand trike. And she uses that to kind of get to the kind of London edge and then, you know, kind of goes into town using that. But she's now got a kind of e-bike kind of kit for it. And she's saying that that in turn, you know, makes it much easier for her to travel, you know, a reasonable number of miles. So it's something which, as the battery life gets better and better, and as hopefully e-bikes get cheaper and cheaper, I think even Britain will start to see more of them.
Do you think it's strange that the British government does seem to like to talk about electric cars a lot, and there are these new policies for supporting electric cars and subsidizing electric cars and making electric cars available to people and charging points and all that kind of stuff, and they specifically exclude electric bicycles, pedal assist bicycles. And I think the reasoning is, whoever it is who sets the policy in Department of Transport thinks that electric bikes are simply taking people who ride a normal bike, pedal-only bike, and making it easy for them, rather than taking someone out of a car, which is a fundamental misunderstanding of how it works.
I would like to think that that's going to change. I really get kind of slightly annoyed, again, in a slightly crankish way, about always seeing these electric charging points. You know, like the local supermarket that I use has got two electric charging points, which are kind of right next to the entrance. And they're never, ever used. I've never seen an electric car being charged there. You know, I've seen lots of kind of non-electric cars. They just use them as an everyday parking space. But the amount of infrastructure, amount of money that's invested in that. And, you know, obviously, if you're going to live in a city full of, you know, diesel cars, and electric cars are better, but they still give many of the same problems. They take too much space. They don't give people any physical activity, you know, all the kind of things like that. They can still kill people. And I think, yes, e-bikes are a massive, massive missed opportunity for ministers. And I really hope that that's going to change.
And do you think that technologies like Uber, that's kind of lowering the cost of getting around by taxi, and things like Zipcar, which in the UK, I'm sure it's, I think it's come from America, Zipcar. It's basically where you have a membership of a car club and you can check out a car for a weekend or a couple of hours and you don't actually own a car. Do you think that these new disruptive technologies that are coming in that are essentially breaking the ownership link between people and the cars that they drive, do you think that is going to be part of what breaks us out of this suboptimal equilibrium of car culture and maybe opens up a few chinks of light for bicycles and for people to not feel quite so committed to the car?
I think it's a possible thing. I mean, you know, this is when you get into the kind of, you know, future gazing stuff, it gets quite difficult. But I think this idea of this kind of sharing economy does make a lot of sense when it comes to cars, because, you know, the stats are that if you do own a car, for most people it's just outside doing nothing, just kind of gradually losing money for about 95% of the time, which is not a very efficient way to use, you know, something that costs an awful lot of cash. And one of the interesting people I spoke to was someone who's very senior in this, people called Sidewalk Labs, who are a kind of Google spin-off, kind of. They're not officially part of Google, but they're very much kind of backed by them and have got lots of kind of Google people. And their task is to focus on how technology can change the way kind of urban life is. And this guy I was talking to, his theory, I mean, he was saying that anyone who says they can predict what the future is going to be like in 10 or 15 years, you know, probably doesn't know. But his guess is that it's going to be the driverless car technology that will really change it. And, you know, he's saying that it's quite possible that in a couple of decades' time, then an awful lot of people won't bother having a private car, because you can have this kind of municipal or city-wide, almost municipal Uber-type system with driverless cars, where if you need to go somewhere, then you use a kind of app on your phone, it'll be summoned to you, and then you can kind of travel to wherever you need to go. And one of the interesting things he was saying is that obviously, if the technology works, and that's a big if, then driverless cars can, in theory, go that much more quickly and don't get caught up in jams. He's saying that his personal theory is he thinks that the suburbs, particularly in cities and estates, where obviously a lot of the suburbs are very, very big, and some of them, you know, have seen quite bad times, could be rejuvenated, because rather than having to drive for an hour and a half to get into a city centre, you could do it in a driverless car in 20 minutes. You know, and that kind of begs the question, where do bikes come into all of this? And his theory, and again, this is just one person's view, is that as time goes on, people are increasingly keen on having a kind of immediate environment in which they live and also in which they work, which is less kind of dominated by cars, where you kind of walk and sit at kind of pavement cafes and ride bikes around. So his grand theory is you'll see a lot of bike use for example, the first mile or the last mile or the last couple of miles. But then you can pick up this kind of, you know, app summoned driverless car to take you anywhere longer than that. And it's an interesting idea. And there is, you know, equally the possibility that in 20 years' time, we're just in a driverless car future, which, you know, fewer people drive on the roads, but it's in some ways even worse. You know, you don't even get kind of someone, you know, looking through the car window. It's just this kind of anonymous speeding blob. And I genuinely don't know, but, you know, it's kind of an interesting thought.
It certainly is. I just don't know what to make of driverless cars. Or we are going to see them, though, aren't we? We are going to see them in our sort of time horizons.
Well, it's actually changing now. I mean, car insurance premiums are starting to drop because the sort of technologies which have been used in driverless cars, which stop people from reversing their car into another car, are already being introduced. You're getting fewer and fewer of the kind of low-level bangs and smashes, which, you know, account for a lot of the in insurance premium. You know, it is starting to take place now.
Well, gazing into the future. Peter, your book is Bike Nation, How Cycling Can Save the World. It's out in Britain, in the United States, simultaneously, I think. And you're going to be going on a world tour as well, talking about it. Where are you going?
I've got a few dates being arranged. I'm going to Newcastle in April. I'm hopefully going to Manchester at some point in the future. I'm going to be going to Glasgow later in the year. I'm hopefully going to be visiting a local bookshop very near to you. That still has to be sorted out. And basically, I will go anywhere where people want to hear me speak.
Well, that's a terrific invitation. I hope you get a lot of people responding to that from, you know, the Bahamas and Hawaii and interesting cycling places like that. Well, thank you very much for your time and for sharing your take on where the world is as a collection of bike nations or potential bike nations. And as I said, the book is published by Yellow Jersey Press. And I enjoyed it immensely. It was a real shot in the arm for me as a kind of someone who thinks about these things and cares about these things and wants to actually do stuff in my local area.
It's been a complete pleasure. Thank you very much.
I was in conversation with Peter Walker, author of Bike Nation, How Cycling Can Save the World. And you can follow Peter or send him a message on Twitter. He is PeterWalker99. If you like listening to The Bike Show and you want to give us a helping hand to reach other listeners who might enjoy the show as well, then why not leave a review on the iTunes Music Store or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And not too far away this summer, I'm going to be taking a closer look at cargo bikes on The Bike Show. And I'd love to hear from you if you've got a cargo bike or have had any experience using a cargo bike, or have you got any questions about cargo bikes? I've been talking to some of the movers and shakers in the world of cargo bikes. I think it's a fascinating aspect of cycling and something that's often overlooked. So I'm really looking forward to getting my teeth into it. And if you've got something to add or if you've got a question to ask, now's the time. So send us an email, bikeshow@resonancefm.com, or you can send us a tweet at Jack Thurston, or you can contact me through the Bike Show website, thebikeshow.net. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.